Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Representative Maurice Hinchey, Democrat of New York, who explains why he and 39 other members of Congress have requested that Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald expand his investigation to include the false claims made by the Bush administration to justify the Iraq War. Tom Barry of the International Relations Center, who assesses the militant protests against President Bush and failure to move forward with a hemisphere-wide free trade agreement at the recent Summit of the Americas in Argentina. And Marjorie Cohn of the National Lawyers Guild, who discusses what's at stake as the Senate considers President Bush's new nominee to the Supreme Court, Samuel Alito. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
November 10th marks the 10th anniversary of the hanging of Ken Saro-Wiwa, head of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People and eight fellow activists in the oil-rich Niger Delta. In a new report, Amnesty International claims repression by the Nigerian military and multinational oil giants continues against the people in the Niger Delta. On February 4, 2005, Nigerian soldiers fired at protesters at Chevron's Escravos oil terminal. 2 weeks later, 17 people were killed and two women allegedly raped by Nigerian troops in Odioma. The military raid was purportedly launched to arrest an armed vigilante group. Yet, while 80% of the homes in the village were destroyed, no suspects were captured. A month later, Shell withdrew plans for oil exploration in the area, citing a land dispute. Ken Saro-Wiwa, a writer and poet, was the driving force behind the 1990 Ogoni Bill of Rights that highlighted the lack of representation for the Ogoni people and the shortage of water, power, and jobs. Saro-Wiwa led a grassroots campaign against Shell and the Nigerian government to clean up the environment and for fair payments to oil-producing communities. In 2001, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights concluded that the Nigerian government facilitated the destruction of Ogoni land, including violating the rights to housing, shelter, and life. Dr. William F. Schultz, executive director for Amnesty International USA, charges that it is unconscionable for Nigeria's federal government to continue to turn a blind eye to its own people. Kenneth Tomlinson, chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, who started an investigation of Bill Moyers, has resigned from the CPB board after 2 years in reaction to a critical inspector's report. Tomlinson, who stepped down as CPB chairman in early November, was investigated for using agency money to hire outside consultants to monitor the political content of the program Now with Bill Moyers, without informing the CPB board. According to the Washington Post, the agency inspector, Keith Cones, is also investigating whether Tomlinson violated agency rules in recruiting Patricia DeStacy, a former Republican National Committee co-chair, as the CPB's top executive. The CPB distributes $400 million a year for public television and public radio programming. Tomlinson, a Republican and former editor of Reader's Digest, also served on the board of Voice of America in the 1980s and remains chairman of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which monitors the U.S. government's overseas broadcasting services. The inspector's report on Tomlinson is expected to be released in mid-November. Jeff Chester, executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, observed, "It was time that Mr. Tomlinson stepped down. He engaged in unethical, if not illegal, behavior." Fear of an avian flu epidemic and the subsequent demand for influenza medicine is enriching Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. From 1997 to 2001, Rumsfeld was chairman of Gilead Sciences, a California biotech company that owns the rights to Tamiflu, the flu drug now in high demand as panic spreads about a possible global bird flu outbreak. According to government filings, Rumsfeld owns between $5 million and $25 million in Gilead shares. As talk of the avian flu has increased in recent weeks, Gilead's share price has grown over 30%. Former Secretary of State George Shultz, a Gilead board member, has sold more than $7 million in company stock since January. When Rumsfeld became Secretary of Defense, he recused himself from making any decisions concerning Gilead and consulted a private securities attorney to advise him. In recent months, the Pentagon has become a major buyer of Tamiflu doses for American troops. Congress is now debating making a multi-billion dollar purchase of the flu drug, which is manufactured by the Swiss company Roche, with Gilead getting 10% of sales and royalties. By the end of the year, Tamiflu sales are expected to rise 400% over 2004 sales. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Washington continues to analyze the fallout of Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald's indictment of Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff Louis Libby on charges of making false statements, perjury, and obstruction of justice related to his investigation of who in the White House leaked the name of a covert CIA agent. The indictment and subsequent resignation of Libby emboldened Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid to force the full Senate to conduct an unusual closed-door session on November 1st. The goal of Senate Democrats was to pressure the majority Republicans to conduct a long-delayed investigation into whether the Bush administration exaggerated and manipulated intelligence to justify the Iraq War. After the two-hour session, an agreement was hammered out to have a bipartisan group of six senators report on the Senate Intelligence Committee's progress on completing the investigation by November 14th. An earlier attempt to push the Fitzgerald investigation into dealing with growing questions about the veracity of pre-war intelligence was made by Representative Maurice Hinchey, Democrat of New York. Hinchey, joined by 39 members of the House, sent Fitzgerald a September 15th letter requesting an expansion of his investigation to include the administration's false claim that Iraq had sought uranium in the African nation of Niger to build a nuclear weapon. The letter also requests that the special counsel look into whether the administration violated federal law that prohibits making fraudulent statements to Congress. Between the Lines, Richard Hill spoke with Representative Maurice Hinchey, who explains why he initiated the letter to Fitzgerald and what he hopes will result from the growing pressure on Congress to hold Bush administration officials accountable for a war that many Americans now believe was waged on the basis of lies.
I suggested to Mr. Fitzgerald that in addition to the importance of revealing who it was that revealed the identity of the undercover agent Valerie Wilson, Mrs. Wilson, it was important to ask the question why that revelation took place and how it was associated with the fabrication of information and intelligence which led up to the war in Iraq. It's become increasingly clear that the information that the administration presented to Congress as a reason for going to war, that is, the so-called weapons of mass destruction, and particularly the idea that Iraq was importing enriched uranium from Niger, was completely false. And a growing amount of evidence indicates that the highest-ranking members of the administration knew it was false when they presented that information. So my request to Mr. Fitzgerald was to ask him to expand his investigation beyond who it was that revealed Mrs. Wilson's identity, and to ask the question why that was done, and in the course of asking that question, to examine the issue of the fabrication of information and intelligence presented to the Congress to justify the congressional resolution authorizing war in Iraq.
Since you have presented this letter to Patrick Fitzgerald, has there been any kind of reaction either from the prosecutor or from your colleagues in Congress or from any other quarters?
There has been no direct response from the prosecutor. We didn't anticipate that there would be, but we believe that it's important that he focus in this way, and he may be focusing in this way. Today, we've seen something very dramatic happen, and that is that the Democrats in the United States Senate have requested that the Senate go into closed session in order to investigate this issue of falsified information and to determine why the Senate Intelligence Committee has not fulfilled its obligation, which it said it would, that obligation being to investigate the falsification of information by the executive branch and to add that to the report that it presented to the Senate and to the American people last fall, just before the election. So things are beginning to happen, and I'm very interested and encouraged by what is taking place in the Senate right now. We finally have more Democrats who are willing to stand up and stipulate that this administration has taken this nation to war based upon forged and falsified information.
Do you see a failure at the congressional level in terms of investigating this issue? It seems that that's what happened in the Watergate era. Congress picked up the investigation track, and that's what really led toward the impeachment of Nixon.
Well, you're absolutely right. There is no question that this Congress has failed in its obligations to investigate this matter. We have our Constitution, which is the basis for all the laws of our country. And in that Constitution, you have the stipulation of separation of powers and the various allocations of responsibility between the executive and the legislative branches. The legislative branch has the responsibility to oversee the executive branch, to make sure that the executive branch, with all of its power, is not using that power in unlawful ways or in ways that are contrary to the law or to our Constitution. The problem is that the Republicans here in Washington control both the White House and the Congress. And the Republicans in the Congress have refused to stand up and exercise their responsibilities to investigate what appear to be very serious crimes by this administration. And that has to be changed. I am very deeply distressed by what is happening to our country here under this monolithic government that rules the nation presently in Washington, both at the executive branch and the legislative branch. Now, it's very, very important that the truth be revealed here. We've allowed our country to engage itself in an illegal, unjustified, immoral war in another country. We've allowed this administration to attack another country without any reason, any legitimate reason whatsoever. And that is something that we, as Americans, cannot tolerate. We've got to get to the bottom of this, and we have to do it as soon and as thoroughly as possible.
That was Representative Maurice Hinchey, Democrat of New York. Read his Fitzgerald letter online at Hinchey's website at www.house.gov/Hinchey. President George Bush may have hoped that a weekend in Argentina would be a respite from the successive scandals suffered by his administration at home, but as has happened often during his presidency, Mr. Bush was greeted at the summit of the Americas in Mar del Plata by tens of thousands of peaceful demonstrators and street violence by a smaller group in the seaside resort. President Bush, the most unpopular U.S. president in recent Latin American history, met with 33 heads of state representing every nation in the Western Hemisphere except for Cuba. Among the top issues addressed by the summit was Washington's long-running effort to implement the hemisphere-wide free trade area of the Americas. But in the end, progress on FTAA was blocked by five nations: Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Venezuela, who opposed a deadline of April 2006 for a new round of talks. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez, a staunch opponent of free trade, dominated coverage of the summit when he led a rally with soccer star Diego Maradona against President Bush, attended by 25,000. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tom Barry, policy director with the International Relations Center, who assesses the popular opposition to the FTAA across Latin America and the viability of progressive alternatives for economic development and integration.
There wasn't just a deadlock here. The deadlock has existed since 2001 at the Summit of the Americas in Quebec. And actually, it's a surprise that to the degree that the free trade area of the Americas became so prominent in the agenda of the summit. The United States trade agenda has not focused on the free trade area of the Americas in the last several years, but has been focused on sub-regional and bilateral free trade agreements. And Hugo Chavez made the FTAA the issue of this summit, and in doing so, cast attention on the problems that have been created by other free trade agreements and made himself the center of attention at this summit. Argentina in particular, there is a strong reaction to not necessarily free trade, but neoliberal policies that have devastated the Argentine economy, and so that the militancy, I think, that we've seen in the news reports from Argentina have more to do with a reaction to the Washington consensus, the failure of neoliberal policies, and the buy-in of those policies by their own government officials. They don't want anything more coming from Washington in the way of economic policies, whether they be economic reforms, privatization, or in the way of free trade.
Tom, give us a couple of examples of the policies that have been encouraged and sought by Washington that have failed so miserably in Latin America. What are those policies specifically, some of them, and how have they been a disservice in the view of many throughout Latin America?
Well, it's a move away from social democratic policies that where there's a social contract between business, labor, and the population in general and the government to a contract between government and corporations, whether they be local corporations or foreign corporations. And so part of that policy is privatization of companies that have been previously owned by the government, cuts in spending for things like pensions and so on, so to be more fiscally conservative. And becoming more fiscally conservative, it wiped out the welfare of hundreds of thousands of people, thus destroying the buying power, thus bringing down the economy. With free trade, the question is of destroying livelihoods by the entrance into the economy of cheap and oftentimes subsidized imports from the United States or other industrialized countries. And that is an issue, really, that came to play in Mar del Plata, where there were five countries that were opposing moving forward with free trade negotiations, one of them being Venezuela, which doesn't have anyone have anything to do with the United States or anything to do with free trade, and then the Mercosur countries in the Southern Cone that are ag exporters, and they can't compete against the subsidized U.S. exports and can't get their products, their major agricultural exporters can't get their products, whether it be sugar, cotton, oranges, into the United States market. They see that the free trade is hypocritical, they want free trade seriously in the sense of cutting down all tariffs.
What are people like President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and other progressive activists and politicians proposing in terms of an alternative?
I come down on the kind of cynical side of that question. You have on the one side what I see is a lot of rhetoric and a lot of money on the part of Hugo Chavez that is spreading that money to win political favors and also to assuage problems of poverty and to increase education, but we're really not talking about development here, and that really needs to be on the agenda, and it's a challenge that that Latin Americans have not fully faced, and it's easy to see why, given the failure of other paradigms, whether they be the social democratic economies of Europe, traditional communist socialist bloc, and the failures of neoliberal models. So that we're at a point where those alternatives are just now being thought at. There are groups talking, NGOs, who are talking with governments about sub-regional, regional alliances that are not based on cutthroat competition, not based on free trade, but more on a mutual development, but they're very incipient.
That was Tom Barry, Policy Director with the International Relations Center. Contact the center by calling area code 505-388-0208 or visit their website at www.irc-online.org. The withdrawal of Harriet Myers, President Bush's first nominee to fill the Supreme Court seat being vacated by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, demonstrated the power of Mr. Bush's Christian conservative base, who were very unhappy with his choice. Well organized and campaigning hard for a Supreme Court nominee in the mold of Justices Antonin Scalia or Clarence Thomas, the movement was elated with President Bush's second choice, Samuel Alito. Alito, a judge serving 15 years on the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, has been nicknamed by some Scalia Light or Scalito for his judicial kinship with Justice Scalia. But progressive groups concerned about the balance of a new post-O'Connor court are alarmed by Alito's opposition to reproductive rights, including his 1991 decision supporting a Pennsylvania law requiring women to notify their spouses when seeking an abortion. Progressive groups are also troubled by Alito's record on race and sex discrimination, corporate power, police abuse, civil liberties, and gun control. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson's School of Law and president-elect of the National Lawyers Guild. She discusses how Judge Alito, if confirmed, could radically alter U.S. law on a wide range of issues and the prospects of a Democratic filibuster in the Senate.
Well, what happened, I think, as a result of the failed Myers nomination is that Bush wanted to make sure that the same thing didn't happen again, so he picked someone in the person of Samuel Alito who would be very, very attractive to his right-wing base. And sure enough, they celebrated, and they're still celebrating. They're very, very pleased with Alito. In my opinion, Alito would certainly move the Supreme Court to the right, whereas O'Connor, who was a conservative justice, was the swing vote in many cases. She would swing to the right or the left. She did not have an ideology. She would look at each case on a case-by-case basis. Alito, with very few exceptions, is generally very, very conservative, very right-wing. And I suspect from everything that I have seen about him and the decisions that he has made as a judge on the Court of Appeals that he would eviscerate abortion rights if given the chance, that he would overturn Roe v. Wade. When he's been on the Third Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in Philadelphia for 15 years, and when the case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey came to his court, he actually voted to uphold a Pennsylvania law that included a provision that would require women seeking abortions to notify their spouses. But when that case reached the Supreme Court actually used the Casey case to reaffirm Roe v. Wade, and Justice O'Connor wrote the decision, and that decision struck down the state's spousal notification requirement. So I think that he would overturn Roe v. Wade if it came to him. He also has shown very little judicial restraint, and that's a word that the right wing likes to use. They don't like activist judges. They like judicial restraint. But Alito has shown very little judicial restraint when he voted in several cases to strike down statutes of Congress. That is an activist judge. And those statutes would have made it easier for civil rights plaintiffs to prove sex and race discrimination. In one case, Alito's colleagues on the Third Circuit said that the federal law prohibiting employment discrimination would be eviscerated if our analysis were to halt where Judge Alito suggests. He has done other things which have shown much more activism than restraint. He voted to invalidate part of the Family and Medical Leave Act, which is a congressional statute that guarantees most workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave to care for a loved one. And the Supreme Court reversed an opinion by Alito, which found that Congress had exceeded its power in passing the law. So there again, the Supreme Court disagreed with Alito on the issue of workers' rights. He supported upholding the unauthorized strip searches of women and children who are not named in a search warrant. It was a search warrant for a man, and the police came in and strip searched the mother and her 10-year-old daughter, even though they were not named in the search warrant. And even Michael Chertoff, who was on the Third Circuit at the time and is now Bush's Homeland Security Director, accused Alito of rubber-stamping police misconduct in that search and seizure case.
Marjorie Cohn, tell us what your gut feeling is about how the Democrats are going to approach this nomination. The last big fight we saw on Capitol Hill over this Supreme Court nomination was Robert Bork. Do you think is as much at stake now as it was back then? And do you think organizations, grassroots groups all over this country will pressure the Democrats to filibuster or do whatever they have to do to derail the Alito nomination?
Well, I think that groups are pressuring the Democrats. There are organizations including the National Lawyers Guild, the AFL-CIO, NARAL, Pro-Choice America, the Alliance for Justice, Planned Parenthood, MoveOn.org, Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, all opposing the Alito nomination. And when Bush first named Alito as his nominee, key Democrats immediately stepped up to the plate and challenged the nomination. Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid, Senator Patrick Leahy, Senator Ted Kennedy, Charles Schumer, John Kerry, Barack Obama. But what has happened more recently, in an article I read, Joe Biden is starting to say, well, as it looks right now, we'll probably give him an up or down vote. And I see some of the Democrats now saying, you know, kind of backing off a bit. And it's really kind of distressing, especially since we haven't even had the Senate Judiciary hearings. They're set for, I believe, January 9th. So if the Democrats and Democrats like Joe Biden are already saying, well, we're not going to filibuster before they've even heard the testimony or seen the records, I'm not sure that there really is going to be much of an appetite on the part of the other Democrats to filibuster, which is really a shame because I really think the Democrats should have insisted that Bush appoint a moderate to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, who was a moderate.
That was Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and president-elect of the National Lawyers Guild. Contact the Lawyers Guild at 212-627-2656 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.